As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
The Athletic.
Hello, you're listening to the Athletic Football Tactics Podcast, a show that focuses on football tactics, on tactical trends, and the use of data in helping us better understand the game that we love. I'm Ali Maxwell. I've got Mark Carey with me. Hello, Mark.
Hi, Ali. Glad to be back.
I am not the Athletic's in-house statistician, but I reckon you might have got close to breaking the record for number of articles released on one day, on deadline day. I think I counted at least five with your name on the byline, of course, often in collaboration with other Athletic writers, and from the looks of things, trying your best to help fans learn more about the players that they signed and where they may or may not fit into their team.
Yeah, it's just a case of giving an overview to the fans at this stage. Hopefully we'll do more stuff when the players actually had a few games for their respective new teams. But yeah, there's been a lot to kind of get through. Looking forward to a bit more sleep soon. But no, it's been a fun one. Transfer, you know, the transfer window in general was fun. But being in the office as well on transfer deadline day was quite something to behold. So yeah, really enjoyed it.
Michael Cox is here too. Hello, Michael.
Hi, Ali. Hi, Mark.
Tell me, how was Totally Football Show live on Tuesday night?
Yeah, it was very pleasant. We did a live show for the Totally Football Show, which, regardless of there being anyone in the audience, was our first in-person pod for 2 years. And we had 400 people came along to see us at Leicester Square Theatre, which is a lovely theatre in central London. And yeah, it was just very nice to see people and see so many listeners. It was great.
It looked great fun. It's certainly something for us to aspire to, I think. Also, I noted from the pictures I saw on Twitter today, you were the smartest dressed of the panel by quite some distance. Did they stitch you up with the dress code? Or
no, I think it's the dumb thing to dress up reasonably smart. And Duncan Alexander and Julian Laurent came along as if they were tracksuit type numbers. But I bet if you were doing a live performance, you'd be very smart, Ali. I think you're in my camp for this one.
Possibly. Maybe we'll find out one day. Look, before we get into our topics, and it's a two-topic week on the pod this week, I want to ask you, Michael, about Everton, because it's been a very busy week for them. I dare say they're the sort of club we might look at in more depth when there's a bit more water under the bridge being Frank Lampard's tenure in charge. That doesn't make sense at all, but I think you know what I'm getting at. It's been a week of arrivals, Frank and Dele and Donny. What do you make of Everton's appointment of Frank Lampard? What might we expect them to look like tactically?
Yeah, that bridge pun would have made more sense at his previous job, I think, wouldn't it? But I vaguely understand what you mean. I think Everton's a really interesting situation because I think they... a lot of people are saying that they did very well on deadline day to get in Van der Beek and Dele Alli. And I suppose they did in terms of individuals, even if they're you know, two players who haven't played much recently. But I must say, I think their situation in the Premier League is slightly more perilous than maybe people have acknowledged. I mean, at the moment, they're only 4 points away from the relegation zone. They have appointed someone who I don't think has a great track record in terms of his management so far. He did an okay job at Derby and an okay job at Chelsea. Pretty much maintained the level that they'd been at previously. So they do need an uplift. Whether that will come from the signings or come from Lampard, we'll have to wait and see. We did do a podcast on Lampard at Chelsea tactically. I think he did show some good ideas there. Times good use of kind of changing formations. I remember a victory over Mourinho's Tottenham was particularly impressive when he went with the three at the back. But there's a lot that needs to be done at Everton. I mean, almost every department in their side, I think, has looked quite ropey this season. So I think it's quite a tough job. And like I say, I really think they're in a relegation fight at the moment.
Mark, have you had a thought about the fit of Ali and Van der Beek for this Everton side and Lampard as manager? I seem to remember in that podcast we did, Michael, I think Tom spoke about the numbers suggesting that Lampard was very keen for his team to press. But perhaps when you dug a little deeper, the structure of the press and the organisation of it maybe wasn't as strong as some of the other top teams. So that'll be something to keep an eye on. But Mark, what do you make of those signings in particular?
Yeah, it was something I was speaking about with some of the writers only this week, of just how it will kind of fit in terms of formation, how that will work. And as Michael said, that, you know, Dele and Van der Beek haven't had a great deal of minutes. So when you're thinking about pressing and making sure that you kind of got that high intensity, which will be a move away from how Everton were under Benitez, you think, well, yeah, how long will it take for them to do that? Because you need kind of more minutes in the legs, get back to match fitness. So they haven't got time on their side, Everton. They, as you say, Michael, they've got to get some points fast and really kind of get that transition quickly. So it'll be interesting one to see. I'm interested to see what the formation will be and how it will work. But just feels like they're just being pulled from pillar to post at the moment, Everton. So it's anyone's guess at the moment.
Well, it is, as mentioned, a two-topic week, and let's get stuck in. Both of these are inspired by articles on site at the moment that felt right up our street. We couldn't ignore them, really. One of them is a quick chat about the rise and fall of three-man defences in the Premier League. Michael alluded to it on the pod last week and wrote it up in between. Then we'll have a discussion about receiving passes. That one's based on the big ticket, John Muller's very good article. Won't somebody please credit the pass receiver? More detail on that to come. Sadly, John isn't able to join us today, but my dual MCs, Mark and Michael, are ready to chat about what is a very interesting topic. Let's start with three at the back in the Premier League, Michael, the rise and fall. I want to start pre-rise, really. There's one name that springs to mind, and that's Antonio Conte. But before Conte's arrival in the Premier League, you've called it dormant, really, in terms of three-man defences and their use before 2016-17, almost untried at that time for a few years. Why was that?
It's a good question, and it's difficult really to answer considering the success of Chelsea in particular, as well as some other sides, with that formation in the last few years. But yeah, I mean, I actually calculated these stats by hand. I basically went through each team for each season and worked out who had played three-man defences. And yeah, go back to 2015-16, and that's the year before Conte joined, of course. And there's only one side in the league who played a three-man defence more than four occasions. That was Southampton under Ronald Koeman, who had a really good mid-season kind of change of fortunes when they changed to that system. The side that used it the second most was Aston Villa, who finished about 20 points off survival, finishing in last place. So I don't think they were ever going to be tactical trendsetters. Mm. It's strange looking back. I mean, it's not like we were completely unaccustomed to the three-man defence in English football. Mm. Towards the end of the 1990s, there was a big shift towards playing with wing-backs. England have done it on a few occasions under Glenn Hoddle, I thought in particular. England were very good when they played that system. But whether it was because English football wasn't producing the right kind of players or whether managers were just tactically inflexible, I think it's fair to look back at that season in general, 2015-16, and the overall managerial quality, I think, was probably not quite there compared to how it's been the last few years. I think of the two real quality eras of management for me. One was the middle of the 2000s when Mourinho and Benitez came over and joined Ferguson and Wenger. And of course, since 2016, we've had almost every great coach in Europe over here. But in between, I think there were a few managers, whether it was Pellegrini or Manchester United, going through some difficult spells. There weren't that many tactically adventurous managers, I would say. And things have changed a lot since then.
And perhaps from the start of its rise, although I've already mentioned Antonio Conte's name, it would be unfair on a couple of other managers, and in particular, a couple of Italian managers, to just focus on Conte. Talk me through its nascent rise from 2016-17 onwards.
Yeah, that's the interesting thing because, I mean, at the start of the 2010s, there weren't that many three-man defenders in the Premier League at all. The one country where it was very popular was Italy. And I would say there was three managers who really excelled in that respect. One was Walter Mazzarri, who created a brilliant Napoli team that came relatively close to winning the league, and they played 3-4-3. And the other was Francesco Guidolin, who did a really good job at Udinese with Alexis Sanchez and Antonio Di Natale up front. And Conte came after that, Juventus, and shifted to a 3-5-2, having initially started with a 4-2-4, as we mentioned in, I think, last week's podcast. And the funny thing is that those three managers then found themselves in English football at the same time. Mazzarri was at Watford. He used it at the start of that 2016-17 season. Guidolin only used it once, and it was actually against Conte shortly before Conte switched that system. Actually, it didn't work out in that Swansea game. He actually abandoned the system just before half-time. But Conte was, yeah, the third Italian manager that season to use a three-man defence in the Premier League, and we all know how successful it was. Took Chelsea from seventh to top, and they stayed in first position and ended up on 93 points, which at the time was the second most that had been recorded in the Premier League.
And when Chelsea started dominating the division, having switched to the 3-5 or the 3-4-3 rather under Conte, and when the likes of yourself started writing about its benefits tactically and why the switch had been so effective, one of the things that you spoke about was how opponents were really struggling defending with a back four against Chelsea's front five. Now these are now tactical concepts that come quite easily, that are fairly recognisable, I think. But as you mentioned, at the time, it was so different and so new as to be incredibly effective immediately. It made complete sense when you explained it. And it seemed quite simple, almost quite obvious, you know, numerical advantages in key areas of the pitch. And of course, quite quickly after Conte adopted it, it became like yo-yos and Pokemon, which gives you an idea of the era I grew up. It became a huge craze, right? For a good few years after that.
Yeah, and the interesting thing is that so many managers tried it for the first time against Chelsea because they were so scared of their back four being overloaded. So they just matched the system. And I went through and, again, did this all by hand. It was quite time-consuming. But, I mean, that season, Sunderland used a four-man defence for the first 16 games and then switched to a 3-4-3 when they played Chelsea. Eddie Howe's Bournemouth used a four-man defence for the first 17 games of the season, then switched to three at the back when they played Chelsea. Claudio Ranieri, I think, had gone 60 games at Leicester with a back four, switched to a 3-4-3 or 3-5-2, actually, when they played Chelsea. So you just see the real direct impact of having to face Chelsea. And, of course,
do you think on balance, it's very difficult to measure because we'll never have an example of what would have happened had they stuck with the normal formation. Do you think on balance that was a good approach to try and quash Chelsea's threat to match them up, even though you know you're not going to be able to implement the ideas as well as Conte's well-oiled machine? Can you understand why teams did that and did it work?
I do understand why they did it. And I think in general it did work. I mean, a few of those sides lost. I mean, Sunderland, for example, were pretty dreadful that season and went down. But, I mean, they lost 1-0 at Stamford Bridge because, you know, they did counteract some things. Chelsea did well. So, yeah, I do understand it. And I think in general, matching, just preventing Chelsea from forming that 5-4, I think, was really important. And the first side to beat Chelsea in this run, I think after 13 straight victories, was Tottenham, who used a 3 at the back. Well, used the same system and exploited a very obvious weakness in the Chelsea side with the same goal twice scored by Dele Alli. I kind of understand why they switched to it. And I think Brawley was quite successful for a lot of teams, including Arsenal, who had gone 1,000 games under Wenger with that system and then beat Chelsea in the cup final.
But Conte leaves after two seasons in 2018, so that's still 3.5 years ago. And, you know, the craze doesn't really slow down at that point, does it? There's a few managers in particular that have a real taste for it at this stage, Michael, and a couple very specifically whose three-at-the-back systems have a big impact on their team's success. Not like Conte in winning the title, but in taking teams such as Wolves under Nuno, Sheffield United under Chris Wilder, from championship promotion to mid-table top half in the Premier League.
Yeah, that's interesting because like you say, they came up with that system and have really perfected it before they came into the Premier League. And it wasn't like a surprise when they used it. And within those systems, I think they were quite innovative in a way. I think particularly Sheffield United, we've spoken about them many times before. But Connor Cody at Wolves is just such an unusual kind of role, almost like an old school sweeper. So yeah, they were the sides really that were kind of, after Conte had gone, like you say, they were the ones who really took up the slack. And I think the other one was Newcastle under Benitez, which was a little bit less innovative and more him wanting to shore up a defence with an extra defender. But yeah, despite Conte's departure, there was a couple of seasons where it was still relatively common to see about between 21 and 25% of lineups featured a three-man defence in the two seasons after Conte left.
So this is the Athletic Football Tactics podcast. We're currently talking three-man defences in the Premier League. They were everywhere and now they're mostly gone. Let's touch on the peak and the decline. Next up.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard it right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask me. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
So, Michael, with your pen and your paper, an incredible use of your time and brain power, you've tracked three at the back systems in the Premier League all the way to its peak last season. What are we talking?
29.9% of Premier League lineups are three-man defence.
That's a lot.
Quite high. That is quite high. Yeah, I mean, we're talking Graham Potter at Brighton usually used it a lot of. Leicester's lineups under Rodgers, West Ham under Moyes, Chelsea obviously after Tuchel came in. So there's quite a few there.
And lots of different interpretations as well.
Yeah, I think that is fair to say. I mean, I suppose the caveat here is the only side who stuck with it in every game was Sheffield United, who finished bottom. And the top three sides between them only used it three times. Manchester United didn't at all. Liverpool didn't at all. Manchester City did it on three occasions. With City, it's fluid enough that they sometimes switch to the back three in possession. But it was, not particularly popular amongst the top sides until Tuchel came to Chelsea.
I just want to come in and just say that I'm slightly sweating at the idea of you doing all of this by hand, Michael. But it's very impressive, nonetheless.
You know, Mark could have done this at the click of like three buttons, three clicks of one button.
Yeah, I mean, by hand is a slightly generous interpretation. It's very much on in Excel, I should say.
No, I'm very impressed.
But I'll send you this spreadsheet, Mark. This is quite a nice spreadsheet, in my opinion.
Yeah, no, I could maybe do something with it. It'd be interesting to see it. But I think you said within your piece, which I thought was great, that it shows just how teams are kind of flexible between games and being able to adapt, but also kind of within games as well. And it kind of shows the tactical flexibility, but also the tactical understanding now, I suppose, which I guess kind of comes with the influx of these managers who are trying to, I guess, designed to educate the players just that little bit more, to such that teams can adapt within the game, two or three at the back, however it may be.
And I guess a tactical awakening in the Premier League is great news for a tactics writer, Michael, in terms of, well, interesting stories. It also makes your job a little bit harder when there's so much in-game tweaking going on. You really do have to be on your game, just, you know, on a match-to-match basis.
Yeah, that is true. And of course, some systems do appear a little bit like a three-man defence, even when they defend with the back four, so Manchester City and Arsenal being obvious candidates there. But yeah, I tended to take it as the defensive base of the formation. This season's been quite interesting in terms of the line graph of sides they've used a three-man defence.
It's almost all gone, right? What are the reasons for such a sharp decline? Do you think it's lost its sort of shine of intimidation in its solidity, or is it a case of once everyone starts doing it, the edge suddenly becomes in trying to do something else?
In week 8 of the Premier League, there were 9 of the 20 sides used a back three. And then last weekend, or the most recent weekend, because we're in a little bit of a mini break, there's only two sides who used it, and two is the lowest for almost 2 years. So I don't really know whether it's a widespread shift away because of common factors or whether it's individual factors within teams. But I mean, funnily enough, the two sides who used it were playing against each other, Wolves against Brentford, who have both used that system throughout this campaign. But yeah, there does seem to have been a shift away from it. And of course, that Spurs-Chelsea game, which I think we mentioned last week, where both sides used a four-man defence, that kind of summed it up, because Conte and Tuchel are the two managers that you would associate most with the three-man defence.
Well, it certainly hasn't declined in the EFL in the second, third and fourth tiers. About 50% of the 72 EFL clubs playing three at the back systems. And yeah, I, before we move on, Michael, I wanted to ask you whether the opinion that I hold has any sort of tactical merit. I always groan when I see, you know, if I'm watching a game on a Friday night and I see both teams lining up in a 3-5-2, for example, I sort of inwardly groan. I have this idea that three at the back versus three at the back makes for generally quite a boring game. And of course, you know, football tactics and what makes a game interesting or boring is subjective to an extent. But do you think that's a fallacy, saying that three at the back versus three at the back is boring?
I think there's some validity to it. I think there's a big difference between 3-4-3 and 3-5-2, though.
Yeah.
I mean, if you get two 3-4-3s against each other, it's almost like individual man for man all over the pitch, because they very much match each other up. If it's 3-5-2 against 3-5-2, then both sides have got a spare man at the back. Midfield, there's six players in that zone. It gets quite boggy. And then you've just got two wing backs kind of chasing each other up and down the touch lines. And maybe there's been a bit of a shift now. You do tend to get more kind of attack-minded, tricky players at wing back. But if you just get converted fullbacks, I think there can be basically a lack of guile on the pitch. So no, I kind of agree with you, Ali. I think in general, regardless of whether it's a three or four, I think games where there's different systems against one another is always much more exciting. But yeah, it's interesting to track. I enjoyed doing this article, and I enjoyed doing the numbers despite your jibes. And the good thing about this was, it's the first article I've done that's been cited in a post-match press conference. Because I don't know whether you saw this, but after Arsenal women won in the FA Cup at the weekend, their manager said,
"I read a very interesting article today before the game, again, with statistics on three-man defence in the men's Premier League from 2015 and onwards. And in football, it's general about that. You want to play a game every weekend that you and your players are very used to, but it's a surprise for the opponent because they are not exposed to it often."
Great that we're being read by actual managers.
Well, I mean, it didn't escape me, Michael, that you've written a best-selling book on the history of football tactics in the Premier League. And in your piece about the rise and fall of three at the back systems, you commented on this having been, you know, one of the stronger trends in recent times. I mean, are you just going to be adding this as an extra chapter and trying to pick up some more book sales, you know, from this point? This feels like an obvious extra chapter, doesn't it?
Yeah, there was a brief discussion about whether there should be an update for the 30-year anniversary. I'd be up for it.
I bet you would.
I should correct you that it's actually not a best-selling book. People think that best-selling means just it sold a lot of copies, whereas it actually means something very specific, which I'm sorry to say my book didn't reach that level. You basically have to be in the top 10 in the Sunday Times list in a week to be best-selling. So right. I don't want to be taking credit. I'm not due there, but thank you nevertheless.
This is the Athletic Football Tactics podcast. Next on the agenda with Michael Cox and Mark Kerry. Won't somebody please credit the pass receiver?
This episode is supported by season 3 of FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher division. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenges and rise again into League One? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Yeah, guys, this was a really interesting piece written by John Muller, who's making a bit of a habit of writing really interesting pieces on the Athletic site. And unfortunately, John can't join us to talk us through it. But there was enough that we found interesting together as a trio to think that this was worth a discussion on the pod, because, as mentioned at the top, it is something that's right up our street. Won't somebody please credit the pass receiver? Talk me through it. Michael, talk me through what you found most interesting off the bat and why you thought it was worth a segment on the pod this week.
Yeah, I just thought it was a really interesting article. John's been on the podcast before, so our listeners will know all about him, but he's doing some fantastic stuff with data and interpreting data. And yeah, this was a thing I'm not sure I'd necessarily seen a stat for, although the way that John phrased a couple of his arguments, particularly around expected goals, I thought was quite interesting and made me think maybe I have seen stats like this before without knowing them.
I think as well, from a data perspective, kind of historically, it does open up that conversation a bit more about the dynamic of the team on the pitch, because we do focus a lot, because it's measurable, on events and event data and things that did actually happen, but not so much maybe on the method by which they did happen or didn't happen, I think, but maybe added value. So things where, yeah, a run opened up space for a pass to occur, that's really very difficult to quantify. So that pass receiver can have a lot of value, but it's very, very difficult to quantify. And we'll do our best to talk it through from what John has put based on research that's out there. But I think the conclusion before we even started is that it's a very difficult thing to do.
Yeah, certainly a big task that various people are setting themselves to try and measure the skill of pass receiving, I suppose. Just rowing it back a tiny bit, that the value of in-possession actions, Mark, and we've spoken a lot about this sort of stuff over the last year or two, that's something that's been worked on and refined by a lot of different people in this sphere and a lot of different companies. And I wondered, is it a bit like a sort of arms race in terms of data in football to see who can build the best models and metrics to measure value of in-possession actions?
Yeah, I'd say so. Yeah, it seems that there are a lot of kind of different models which are tapping into ultimately the same sort of thing. And it's kind of largely based around the idea that, well, it's looking beyond shots. That's the kind of main thing, right? Because we've sort of completed shots now in terms of looking at expected goals. We're all in agreement that that's a good, reliable and useful sort of measure of shots. But looking at all the other actions that go towards reaching that stage of shooting is super, super interesting and super valuable, because it actually constitutes a lot of the actions that actually go on the pitch. So there's many models that look at how a player increases or decreases their team's chances of scoring a goal. Essentially, loads of different models that I think was, has been spoken about on the podcast before. So things like expected threat, stats perform, so via Opta, have something called possession value. Stats bomb have something called on ball value. We'll talk today about another model, and American Soccer Analysis, another sort of organization, use goals added, but they all tap into the same sort of thing, as you say, of a model to kind of look to quantify the value that a player has in increasing or decreasing the chance of their team scoring.
You don't have to say which one it is, but quietly, deep down, do you have a preferred model? Is there one you're like, yeah, this is the best?
It'd be like choosing between your kids, isn't it? You're not allowed to say, even though you probably do. Not one I'm willing to say on air, Ali.
Okay. Well, I suppose the next question is measuring the skill of pass receiving, therefore not the in-possession action. That is evidently a little more trickier and comes back to the age-old question or issue, I suppose, of event data versus tracking data, if you could talk us through that.
Yeah, I mean, so as has been spoken about before on the podcast, event data essentially looking at what happens on the ball, so things like passes, shots, tackles, etc. But and don't get me wrong, you know, the football analytics community has come a long way in terms of using event data, and it's unlocked some really interesting work in the football analytics space. But the way that I've heard it described, which I think is a really good way of saying it, is that event data itself is almost like the equivalent of listening to the game of football on the radio, right? Like, you can only actually hear what is happening when, you know, you hear the event, whereas, you know, a lot goes on all around what's, you know, what's happening in that event. So, you know, almost thinking of it like a spotlight in terms of the event, whereas, you know, you actually want to shine a light across the whole pitch in terms of what's going on with the dynamic of the team and both teams. So that's essentially kind of what tracking data is, where it looks at, you know, all of the movement of every player and subsequently the whole dynamic of the team, you know, multiple times per second, which is super useful, super valuable. But there's so much data that, you know, that goes into that, that is quite a lot to kind of break down and simplify and of course quantify as well. So yeah, I think John says it really neatly kind of in the piece, but there's started to get, you know, there's more and more kind of work done in clubs. It's starting to reach more sort of public space here and there, which is really really good to see. But there's kind of examples that I know that Liverpool have done, which they've sort of shared publicly, about things like pitch control, which use tracking data really neatly to show if the ball were to land in a certain spot, which players would be most likely to reach it. And these sorts of dynamic things across the whole, you know, the dynamic of the team is really valuable and can unlock loads from a recruitment perspective, and in general, sort of our understanding of the game. So yeah, event data is very popular. Tracking data is, you know, it's been around for a long time, but very difficult to kind of parse and understand. but yeah, it's definitely a key question to look at the two.
Just as an aside, you mentioned listening to football on the radio. It reminded me that one of the few bits of value I can add to these sorts of discussions is that the phrase back to square one, you know where that comes from, Michael?
I know where you're going to claim it comes from, but it's clearly nonsense.
What?
It's not true. You're saying it's this story about how originally in the Radio Times they printed squares and someone would say where the ball was according to what square was.
The phrase originates from the days when football was listened to a lot on the radio. To help the listener picture the scene, the pitch was divided up into a grid of imaginary squares, square one being around the goal mouth. Thus, whenever the ball went out of play for a goal kick, or someone made a boring back pass of the type no longer allowed, the commentator would groan, "Back to square one." Isn't that great?
There's so many things I don't agree with here. One, I've seen the grid and I don't think number one squares by the goal mouth.
But left
second,
back, isn't it?
I can't believe that anyone really believes it originates from there compared to, say, snakes and ladders or hopscotch, where square one is very obviously a thing. I bet the phrase was used before the first football radio commentary as well. I'm going to ask Susie Dent on Twitter.
I'm sticking with the story. Cox, you mentioned XG, which I didn't necessarily think when I thought we were talking about, you know, receiving passes and trying to measure that skill. I didn't initially think of expected goals as something that would crop up here, but actually it's quite an interesting part of this discussion and kind of makes you think a little bit differently about it.
Yeah, I thought that was a really interesting argument John made. The expected goals really, it doesn't have anything to do with the shot, does it? It's all just about getting in the positions to receive passes. When he put it like that, I suppose we have thought about the skill of receiving the ball in statistical terms without really knowing it. So I thought that was a very good way to introduce the rest of the slightly more complex statistical stuff that was mentioned.
Yeah, it's really, really interesting. John talks to Jesse Davis, who oversees a machine learning group that works on advanced football analytics at the Belgian university, KU Leuven. Mark, they've got a metric called VAEP, valuing actions by estimated probabilities. And that's a possession value model, like we've just spoken about. Various other companies and groups have their own versions. But they've now got an atomic version for the purposes of what we're discussing today, crediting the pass receiver. How do they go about this? What does this measure?
Well, that's the key question, isn't it? I'll do my best to try and, I guess, keep it in sort of simple terms. because we don't need to go into the kind of the maths of it, but the atomic version essentially, yeah, breaks it down into to two parts. So the actual giving credit to the passer, but also the receiver, put simply. So it makes sense, right? It takes two to tango. It takes two to actually have a pass. Otherwise, it's just a loose ball. So it's just, I guess, quantifying what we deem to just make sense in general, of just quantifying the person who gets credit for the actual pass itself, but the person who maybe moves into a really key area of space to receive the ball as well, that player needs to get credit. So the atomic version simply just goes a level up from that possession value model to actually credit the receiver as well.
So if I make a very smart progressive pass, punching it through the lines into the feet of Mark Carey back to goal in a good position, and I've clearly, or we, I should say, have clearly increased our team's probability of scoring a goal from the previous position. Are we sharing the credit there 50-50, passer and receiver, or is it a little more in-depth than that?
Yeah, my understanding of it is that you don't get a 50-50 split. I think the model is kind of advanced enough to be able to show, you know, give value more to one or the other, depending on the action that you say there, Ali. But I think, yeah, this is kind of why it makes sense, right? That if you did give 50-50 each time, then an example like that where someone plays a really neat threaded ball, then there's probably more credit for the passer in one example. But if there's someone who makes a really good run in another example, then they should get more credit as well. So if it was constantly 50-50, it would kind of become a bit of a grey area and you wouldn't be able to kind of tease out who's better or worse. So that's the great thing about this, you know, atomic version, that you're able to really neatly give credit to either the passer or the receiver and weight it as such.
Michael, have you previously spent time thinking along the lines of it would be ideal actually if we could better understand the value of off-ball movement and who excels at that and how in their movement a player, you know, improves the quality of his team or takes away from it? Is that something that you've previously thought in your own work that it'd be great if we had a better measure of this somehow?
Yeah, definitely. I think there's certain players that I've watched over the years, so I think their skill really is their appreciation of space and how they can receive the ball in dangerous positions as much as what they do with it. I think the player currently who I think of in those terms is Mason Mount, who's absolutely brilliantly intelligent at receiving the ball and finding space. And of course is you know, a good goal scorer and can provide an assist. But of all the players like him in English football at the moment or in the England side, if I've got someone, you know, if I can choose someone to have the ball 25 yards out on the edge of the D in terms of what they can do with it next, I'd probably go for Jack Grealish or Phil Foden or maybe Bukayo Saka ahead of Mount, because I think they're just better in those situations. But if Mount, his intelligence means that he can receive the ball more often than those players in those situations, obviously he's got more opportunities to influence the game. So I think Chelsea actually with him and Kai Havertz as well, I think is another one who just reads the play really, really well, understands the opposition and their positioning and how to make runs. I think when those two are playing those support roles, Chelsea have got two players who are just brilliant at that particular skill of receiving the ball. And I think technically, I mean, this isn't what John's article is about, but technically the skill of receiving the ball, I think, is more important than ever. You know, receiving the ball, particularly with your back to player when you're being pressed, whether it's high up the pitch and you know, when your team is being pressed, or because defensive blocks are so compact these days, just receiving the ball is probably more important than ever and probably more valued than ever.
As mentioned, they have got the atomic version of their model and we've got some data from them. We've got some charts. We've got the numbers that suggest who is very good at receiving the ball in the Premier League. Mark, who comes out well at the top of these charts? Who comes out well in terms of pass receiving value?
Well, interestingly, well, the top three are kind of players who you would sort of expect to be, but there's some interesting players on the sort of the top 10 list. So the highest is Diogo Jota, who for some time now, especially since he's moved to Liverpool, has been so brilliant, but really kind of indicative of that, you know, his ability to receive between the lines, and he's quite a determined player. But you know, he's been playing more in central areas as well. But Salah and Mane are both come out in the top three as well. So Liverpool's front three, or three of their now front four, are at the top in terms of their pass receiving value. But there's some interesting names on there as well. So Mikel Antonio is right up there as well. Chris Wood up there. Even Tony and Neil Mopay amongst the top 10 as well. So some really interesting players there. I think the Chris Wood one's an interesting one because it makes sense really kind of as a target man, but it's not kind of, it's almost giving him more credit than I think he kind of gets in terms of being that person and that player that you can play off and actually keep the possession going and get it into him and build the attack from there. So it shows in the numbers that Chris Wood maybe was the signing of the January transfer window. Heard it here first.
It is interesting in terms of the target men on the list, isn't it, Michael? This feels like the sort of metric, you know, it'd be beneficial to them if this became mainstream, because maybe we would develop a slightly greater appreciation of the sort of work that they're doing. Does that mean that with the current stats and metrics that we tend to use in the mainstream, does that mean we end up undervaluing target men types?
Yeah, possibly. Or maybe think about them in different ways. I mean, a lot of the quality of these target men is their ability to bring others into play. I mean, that's what I like about a good target man. Someone like Olivier Giroud, for example. Obviously, he's not on this list because he's not in the Premier League anymore, but he was never a prolific goal scorer, but he was a target man because he can receive the ball with his back to goal. And it does make it easier, doesn't it? I mean, if you've got a player like that who can receive the ball in good situations, he can loft it into them from 30, 40 yards away from the box. Obviously, there's a danger you can do that too much. That's the interesting thing I thought about this article, that the way that the target men come out very well from these metrics.
And the fact that three Liverpool players top the charts, to what extent do we think that's their quality being rewarded in the numbers or reflected in the numbers? And to what extent, you know, might we say, actually, if the top three are Liverpool's front three, then maybe there's team style factors at play or team quality factors at play. I mean, that they are playing in a team with players such as Trent Alexander-Arnold and Andy Robertson, who we know are very good at finding attacking players with very good progressive forward passes. So that's an interesting one to think about, Mark.
So it kind of just shows that it's a two-way street, right? Like we definitely do give credit to Trent Alexander-Arnold because his ability on the ball is fantastic. But if he's playing a ball and there's no one there making the run or finding a pocket of space to receive the pass, then it's, you know, redundant for him to actually pass it, and you get far less credit for it. So I think it kind of shows that it's a bit of a two-way street, and it shows just how good these players are at popping up in spaces. And I'm sure we'll probably come on to Roberto Firmino as well, but it shows just how good they are in getting into those lucrative areas of space to receive the pass, which then combined with the fact that Trent Alexander-Arnold has the ability to execute the pass means that then Liverpool are the team that they are, which, you know, together they're really strong.
And it's interesting, or rather it's notable, that James Rodriguez comes out pretty badly according to this model, Michael.
I can't get over how bad the model makes James look. I mean, just dreadful. I mean, the players around him on that list, I mean, Rian Brewster and Dave McGoldrick and Colin Grant, I mean, he's worse than all of them by quite a long way, which I find interesting because I thought he was quite good last year. I mean, started the season brilliantly, obviously tailed off quite dramatically. But I mean, assuming there's no names missing from that, that suggests he's incredibly bad at receiving the ball, which is bizarre for a player who I think of as, you know, at his best, obviously World Cup 2014, was just absolutely fantastic at receiving the ball between the lines. Most obviously for that goal he scored against Uruguay.
And James Rodriguez! He's a star, all right! A shining, glittering star!
The dipping volley off the bar. I mean, that was a great example of him checking over his shoulder and checking where opponents were, making sure he was in the space and getting the ball between the lines. So, yeah, that's, I don't know whether Rafa Benitez had access to these graphs, but no wonder he wanted to get him out of the door.
Well, we did check with John about this because it's, yeah, as you mentioned, it was something of a surprise to see James reflected quite so poorly in this model anyway. And John did say, you know, it's possible to be a very good player without making off the ball runs or receiving the ball under pressure, but it probably isn't ideal. And that James was outstanding at receiving in safe areas and then playing a creative final pass, which, you know, kind of stacks up, but rarely did the off-ball work to give his teammates dangerous passing options in the final third, or at least compared to more traditional forwards. So that goes some way to explaining it. Michael, in the last part of John's piece, we are introduced to someone whose name's pretty well known, David Sumpter, who's the author of Soccermatics. And really, just to to bring that up as the headline part of his work overlooks a lot of other very interesting things that he's done. John wrote about some interesting work that David Sumpter's doing on this topic basically as well.
Yeah, he's a very interesting guy, David. I've met him a couple of times. And I guess the interesting thing about his work with analytics is he's a bit of an outsider. I mean that in a complimentary way, but I think his work previously was looking at kind of patterns of animal movement and how animals move in herds and stuff, and his application of that to football and tracking data has always been quite interesting. And he actually wrote a very good book about algorithms, which isn't to do with football. So yeah, it was interesting to see his name crop up in this article, and certainly he seemed to be a big proponent of this this type of metric to measure the quality of footballers.
Yeah, he seemed to be able to offer some quite interesting depth, Mark, and some, you know, different types of off-ball movement and its value. A lot of different ideas about how to measure receiving skill using tracking data, which I really liked how it was sort of presented in John's piece. It helps to give a better overview of a player's movement, whether they create space with their off-ball movement by dragging defenders away and disrupting the opposition's defensive structure, or thriving receiving the ball in tight areas, receiving the ball with their back to goal. Some really interesting work.
Yeah, exactly. As you say, there are some of the key ones. He outlines kind of four different ways to measure that, you know, receiving skill. I thought one of them, which I thought was really interesting, was the sort of standing still. Simply standing still is very, very hard to quantify that, because you're not actually doing anything. It's the absence of movement that is actually opening up the space. But I do find that really interesting. And I read something going back a few years now about how Lionel Messi, kind of, I guess, still in his peak, was doing that really well. And if not maybe standing still, then walking and trying to limit his movement while there was kind of almost chaos going on around him, and maybe the opponent's back four, back five, whatever it may be, was shifting around. Him staying still actually ended up opening more space for him to attack and to work out, you know, where to find the most lucrative area. So that's a really difficult one to quantify, which is what John and David say in the piece, but one that I find really interesting.
Yeah, I remember listening to a radio show probably the best part of 10 years ago that was about the use of statistics. And it had Duncan Alexander from Opta on it. And he was alongside, I can't remember who it was. It was an ex-player who was quite a stat skeptic. I think it was possibly Nigel Spackman, someone along those lines. And this player was saying, oh, there's lots of interesting things you do with numbers. But the one thing that, you know, you never get with goals or assists or running data, you haven't got anything for the measurement of when a player stands still, because that can be really important in the game. And at the time, I remember thinking, well, you're never going to be able to create a metric for that. Mm. But 10 years later, it seems they are working towards that.
Very hard to do. Very hard to do, which is what they sort of said, that it's the next thing to really look at. But I think, and it's in the piece from what David said, that it looks to be now that this is just becoming more and more lucrative from a club's perspective and from a recruitment perspective, where there's more publicly available data on, you know, all the stuff that we do enjoy talking about. But this, from a club perspective, is really starting to get a lot of attention for that reason, because if you can quantify those sorts of things and, you know, pin a number to it, can you maybe uncover a player that on the surface doesn't maybe look all that strong or all that likely to fit into your system, but, you know, drawn out by the data from this sort of tracking data, could be like a perfect fit for your club.
Michael, that anecdote was really interesting, because it reminded me of the time that I was listening to a football match on the radio back in the early 1900s, before television had been invented. And this team just kept playing pass back after pass back to the goalkeeper. And commentary, thankfully, was able to explain what was happening by saying, back to square one again. On a more serious note, a lot of the stuff that we're talking about now at the top end of the pitch, in terms of runs that create space, and interestingly, in terms of, you know, former footballers, it is Gary Lineker is referenced in the piece, and you did a whole article alongside Gary Lineker, his game in his words. When you read this, you know, the last section of John Muller's piece here, that must have sprung to mind for you as well, all of the interesting things that Gary Lineker was talking about, the importance of movement as a striker.
Yeah, what sprung to mind for me was, why didn't the editors hyperlink to that article I did with Gary Lineker about it? But yeah, you're right. I mean, he was really interesting in terms of the art of movement and the art of goal scoring, and was quite passionate about, you know, this sixth sense idea. Lineker really hates this idea strikers have a sixth sense. just have to keep on, gambling's the wrong word, but keep on having to get in those positions again and again and again. And if you're there 10 times, eventually the ball will come to you one time. But yeah, he was very dismissive of this idea that you can be in the right place at the right time. You've got to be in the right place all the time, I think was what he said.
So do you think, theoretically, he would be in favour of a metric that was able to quantify how good a striker's movement is, how effective a striker's movement is? Or do you get the feeling that for someone of his generation, they might prefer this not to be something that you can measure, something a little more, I don't know what the right word would be, but something a little more mythical almost?
Yeah, possibly. I mean, it's clear that he places big emphasis upon the value of movement and getting into the right positions. Whether he would want a statistic for that, I don't know. I mean, I also did an article with Alan Shearer about a year ago or so where we talked about movement, and he put a big emphasis upon what he calls the second six-yard box. So as if there was another, kind of a 12-yard box, if that makes sense, and getting into that zone. And he was just talking about how it's all about almost a static position on the pitch you've got to get into. And then I put to him the idea of expected goals and showed him a graph that mapped out the expected goals, almost heat map of where you should be. And I said, did you have that kind of thing in your head? And he was a little bit more sceptical about the expected goals concept. But there's clearly, there's two different approaches. And I think that they are kind of marrying gradually, in the sense that to be a top level footballer, you do have to have a kind of intuitive understanding of these things. And if you are a mere data scientist, you're coming at it from a different perspective and you don't have that knowledge yourself. But the more that kind of there is work in terms of these things, in terms of tracking data, in terms of marrying that to the on-ball data, the more actually things match up with what ex-professionals say, a bit like the thing I said earlier about standing still.
Mark, do you hear anecdotally in your circles about how receptive the very youngest generation of professional players are to this sort of stuff, these sorts of conversations, and what they do being measurable in a way that previously didn't exist? There's so much discussed in the analytics space about how to translate these sometimes fairly dense concepts, metrics, whatever the word is, and translate them into very simple phrases that can be, help with teaching young players to be better. Have you heard about a sort of a greater sense of young players understanding these things and being open to discussing them?
Yeah, I think within clubs you can start to see it kind of more and more. I know people who do work within clubs, and they say, as you say, Ali, that from what I know, that they don't give any kind of technical terms because you want to just speak football language, whether that's even with the coaches or with the players. I think that there's an understanding that this data lark is going to continue for a long time, and it's only going to improve and get bigger. So I think that the players are, within clubs, are starting to understand it more, but almost don't realize that they are kind of getting more and more data fed to them because it's filtered in such a way that it's just clear and just talking football language. So it has, the underlying numbers behind it, but they simply are told, just to get into better positions and things like that. And a few examples come to mind. I think James Maddison did an interesting interview, I think it was last season now, that was speaking with one of the analysts. And I think at the start of this season, Jack Grealish spoke about expected assists, which was a massive victory for the analytics community. So it shows that it started to be kind of more and more within wider football parlance, which I think is really encouraging for the analytics side of things, but still a long way to go, I think.
A very interesting piece, one that makes you think a bit differently, a bit more in depth about the sport, about what matters on the pitch, what adds value and how to measure it. These are all things that we enjoy discussing. That's what we're about on this pod, along with tracking tactical trends. So today's dual topics have been perfect, really, for this week's discussion. It's been a pleasure and an honour to talk to you guys today, Mark Kerry and Michael Cox of The Athletic, and to talk about a great piece from the big ticket, John Muller. I would strongly encourage you to go and read all of their pieces on The Athletic site. In fact, if you head to theathletic.com/tactics, you can get a third off an annual subscription today. That's it from us. Goodbye from myself, from Michael and from Mark. We'll be back again next week, of course, so do join us on the Athletic Football Tactics podcast.
The Athletic.
Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets, and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.